I have something kind of funny that was sent to me on the email. Email is an imitation of our original internet through God consciousness. But sometimes it's nice to have. A friend here at work gave me a clipping of Ann Landers' column from January 1997. It contained real answers given on a Bible knowledge test. Following are a few of the real answers. Answer number one, Noah's wife was Joan of Arc. Answer number two, Lot's wife was a pillar of salt by day and a ball of fire by night. The seventh commandment is, thou shalt not admit adultery. Joshua led the Hebrews in the battle of Jericho. Must have been all old ones. Jesus was born because Mary had an immaculate contraption. Doesn't go into any more detail. The people who followed Jesus were called the 12 decibels. The epistles were the wives of the apostles. One of the opossums was St. Matthew. Paul preached acrimony, which is another name for marriage. David fought the Philistines, a race of people who lived in biblical times. And finally, a Christian should have only one wife. This is called monotony. It's good to laugh. I'd like to read this evening from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. And this is a conversation that Ramakrishna is having with a pundit who came to visit him. The pundit saluted the master with reverence. Narendra, Rakal, Ram, Hazara, and M, who had come with master, seated themselves in the room as near the master as they could, anxious not to miss one of his words. At the sight of the pundit, the master again went into samadhi. After a while, still remaining in that state, he looked at the pundit and said with a smile, "Very well, very well." Then, addressing the pundit, the master said, "Tell me how you give lectures." Pundit, "Sir, I try to explain the teachings of the Hindu scriptures." Master, "For the Kali Yuga, the path of devotion described by Narada is best. Where can people find time now to perform their duties according to scriptural injunctions? Nowadays, the decoctions of roots and herbs of the orthodox Hindu physicians cannot be given to a fever patient. By the time that kind of medicine begins its slow process of curing, the patient is done for. Therefore, only a drastic medicine like the allopathic fever mixture is effective now. You may ask people to practice scriptural rites and rituals, but when prescribing the rituals, remove the head and the tail." In other words, the non-essential parts. The allusion is to the head and tail of fish, which are not essential. "I tell people not to bother with elaborate rituals of the sandhya as enjoined in the scriptures. I say that it will be enough for them to repeat the Gayatri alone. If you must give instruction about scriptural ceremonies, do so to a very few, like Ishan. You may deliver thousands of lectures, but they won't make the slightest impression on worldly people. Can one drive a nail into a stone wall? The point of the nail will sooner break than make a dent in the stone. What will you gain by striking the tough skin of the crocodile with a sword? The Sadhu's water bowl, made from the shell of bitter gourd, made visit the four principal holy places of India with its owner, but it will still remain as bitter as ever. Your lectures are not helping worldly people very much, and you will not realize this by and by. You will realize this by and by. The calf cannot stand on its legs all at once. Now it drops to the ground, and now it stands up. So it learns to stand firmly on its legs and walk. You cannot distinguish a lover of God from a worldly person. It isn't your fault, of course. When the first onrush of the gale shakes the trees, it is impossible to distinguish one tree from another, the mango from the tamarind, for instance. Without having realized God, one cannot give up rituals altogether. How long should one practice the sandhya and other forms of ritualistic worship? As long as he does not shed tears of joy in the name of God and feel a thrill in one's body. You will know that your ritualistic worship has come to an end when your eyes become filled with tears when you repeat, "O Ram." Then you do not have to continue your sandhya or other rituals. When the fruit appears, the blossom drops off. Love of God is the fruit, and rituals are the blossom. When the daughter-in-law of the house comes pregnant, she cannot do much work. Her mother-in-law gradually lessens her duties in the house. When her time arrives, she does practically nothing. And after the child is born, her only work is to play with it. She doesn't do any household duties at all. The sandhya merges into the Gayatri in Om, and Om in Samadhi. It is the sound of a bell, Tam, T-A-M. The yogi, by following in the trail of the sound of Om, gradually merges himself in the Supreme Brahman. His sandhya and other ritualistic duties disappear in the Samadhi. Thus, duties of the yoni comes to an end. As the master talked of samadhi, he himself went into that state. His face radiated a heavenly light. Bereft of outer consciousness, he could not utter another word. His gaze was indrawn and transfixed in communion with the self. After a long time, the master began to recognize the world around him and said like a child, "I shall have a drink of water." Whenever after samadhi, the master asked a drink of water, his devotees knew that he was gradually becoming conscious of the outer world. Still lingering in the state of ecstasy, he said to the Divine Mother, "O Mother, the other day you showed me Pandit Ishwara Chandra Vadiyaskar. Then I told you I should like to see another Pandit, so you have brought me here." Looking at the Pandit, he said, "My child, add a little more to your strength. Practice spiritual discipline a few days more. You have hardly set your foot on the tree, yet you expect to lay hold of a big cluster of fruit. But, of course, you are doing all this for the welfare of others." With these words, he bowed his head before the pundit. The master continued, "When I first heard about you, I inquired whether you were merely erudite or whether you had discrimination and renunciation. A pundit who doesn't know how to discriminate between the real and the unreal is no pundit at all. There is no harm in teaching others if the preacher has a commission from the Lord. Nobody can confound a preacher who teaches people after having received the command of God. Getting a ray of light from the goddess of learning, a man becomes so powerful that before him, big scholars seem mere earthworms. When the lamp is lighted, the moths come in swarms. They don't have to be invited. In the same way, the preacher who has a commission from God need not invite people to hear him. He doesn't have to announce the time of his lectures. He possesses such irresistible attraction that people come to him of their own accord. People of all classes, even kings and aristocrats, gather around him. They say to him, 'Reverend sir, what can we offer you? Here are mangoes, sweets, money, shawls, and other things. What will you be pleased to accept?' In that case, I say to them, go away. I don't care for these things. I don't want anything. Does the magnet say to the iron, come near me? This is not necessary. Because of the attraction of the magnet, the iron rushes to it. Such a preacher may not be a scholarly person, but don't conclude from that he has any lack of wisdom. Does book learning make one wise? He who has a commission from God never runs short of wisdom. That wisdom comes from God. It is inexhaustible. At Kamapukur, I have seen people measuring grain. It lies in a heap. One man keeps pushing grain from the heap toward another man, who weighs it on its scales. So the man who weighs doesn't run short of grain. It is the same with the preacher who has received a commission from God. As he teaches people, the Divine Mother herself supplies him with fresh knowledge from behind. That knowledge never comes to an end. Can a preacher ever lack knowledge, if but once he is favored with benign glance of the Divine Mother? Therefore, I ask you whether you have received any commission from God. Hazra, oh yes, he must have it, to the pundit. Isn't it true, sir? Pundit, commission? No, sir, I'm afraid I haven't received any such thing. Host, he may not have received the commission, but he preaches from a sense of duty. Master, what will a man accomplish by mere lectures without the commission from God? Once a Brahmo preacher said in the course of his sermon, friends, how I used to drink, and so on. Hearing this, the people began to whisper among themselves, what is this fool saying? He used to drink? Now these words produced a very unfavorable effect. This shows that the preaching cannot bring good results unless it comes from a good man. A high government official from Berizo once said to me, sir, if you begin the work of preaching, I too shall gird my loins. I told him the story of people's dirtying the bank of the Halda Pukkar and of it being stopped only when a constable, armed with authority from the government, put up a notice prohibiting it. So I say, a worthless man may talk his head off preaching, and yet he will produce no effect. But people will listen to him if he is armed with the badge of authority from God. One cannot teach others without the commission from God. A teacher of men must have great power. There is many a Hanuman Puri in Calcutta. It is with them that you have to wrestle. Pointing to the people assembled there, these are mere sheep. Chatiananda Deva was an incarnation of God. How little is left of what he accomplished, not to speak of a lecturer who preaches without authority from God. What good will a lecturer do? Therefore I say to you, dive deep in God consciousness. Saying this, the master began to sing in an ecstasy of love for God. Dive deep, O mind, dive deep in the ocean of God's beauty. If you descend to the uttermost depths, there you will find the gem of love. I'd like to speak this evening on finding the gem of love within your own heart. You know, so many individuals these days feel that they are bereft and alone in this world. And there are times that we all truly have felt that way. But what resides within you is this tremendous wealth of spiritual capacity. You know, we live our lives just focused on the material world. We live thinking about our work, about our money worries, about relationships and about families and so on and so forth. But all the time residing deep within us is this rich mineral kingdom of the spiritual that has these incredible gems. But those who are focused on finding everything on the outside in the world are somewhat like Plato's analogy of the cave. And in his analogy, there are those who are seated within the cave, and burning brightly behind them was a fire which cast shadows, their own shadows, on the walls of the cave. These individuals became entranced, watching their own shadows dancing this way and that way. And in this gray-black world of the cave, they came to believe this was all and all of their world. But there was a few who were adventurous, and gradually they turned around and they looked, and they saw this bright light of the fire shining from the mouth of the cave. And so they wandered through that light out into a much brighter, much larger, much more vibrant world than anything they had ever known before inside that cave. Now, since many had only known that cave and its gray and black world, they came to believe that was their all and all. Those who were spiritually adventurous enough to go beyond what they had known and into this greater and brighter world learned what a wonderful place they lived in, what great capacity they had. There were a few who decided to go back into the cave in order to tell those who were still seated, watching the dancing of their own shadows, to turn around, to see that something greater lied in store for them. But because of fear or because of tradition or fixity of mind on those shadows, they refused to do so. And so they adhered to their shadows, believing in them as their entire world, without taking any notice, and sometimes they even beat and abused those who talked of a greater world, saying they were fanciful, that there is no justice in it, that they only cried and bemoaned their own fate, not happy with it, but also not willing to do anything about it. And so we were like that also. We, when we enter on the spiritual path, perhaps read some books, listen to a lecture here and there, and we decide that perhaps there is something more, something outside of our conscious mind that we can aspire to. Perhaps we have had some experiences here and there in the spiritual realm, which has further convinced us that there is a greater reality for us. But like stubborn children, we stay fixed on our own lives. We do very little to change our circumstances. We don't turn around and look for that light. There's a wonderful opening scene of a television show called MASH. And on the opening scenes, they were all looking towards the camera in the direction, trying to find some trace of a helicopter that was supposed to be coming. All the while, you as the viewer of the television could see coming behind them was the helicopter. But they were all faced in the wrong direction, looking out toward the world. And finally, when the helicopter came very near, they heard it and felt it, of course, and so they turned around and they saw what they were looking for was right behind them. In the same way, we take all of our life energy, all of our life force, and we focus it on this world outside of us. Now, really, everything that we experience in this world is an interpretation of our own consciousness, of our own mind. We are told that all sensory experiences comes through the nerves, and once hitting the nerve sends electrical impulses to the brain, and there the brain, whether it comes from the eyes or from the skin or from the taste buds or whatever it comes from, is interpreted there by the brain. But so much of our own lives isn't even lived just in the present of our own sensory experiences. Because of our past experiences, we are perhaps always fantasizing or ruminating about what's gone in the past. Or we are always anticipating what the future will bring to us. And so the brain takes on a further creative ability there and creates a whole fantasy life. Now, the direct information we get from the senses is interpreted through the brain. And then the brain goes on to create a fantasy or imaginary life within ourselves that preoccupies itself with the past or the future or some pure fanciful kind of notions. So how much of the time do we spend in direct perception of truth? You see, very little or none at all. because direct perception of the truth cannot come from the senses. It can't even come from the mind, because the mind has been conditioned through the senses, through our experiences, and through the fanciful preoccupations to be involved with this fantasy life that we are constantly creating for ourselves. So this is not reality. You know, there are those who enter into the spiritual path and they are advised sometimes by their friends, you know, you're not dealing with reality here. And yet, what reality are they speaking of? The reality of the senses? The reality of their own fantasies? Of how they conceive themselves to be? What do we truly know about ourselves? What do we truly understand about who and what we truly are? Now, there are these spiritual gems, we are told, right within us. And in our human ego state, we might say, well, why aren't they more available to us? Why are they difficult? Or why do we only read them about somebody else, and we ourselves don't have more of those experiences? It is because of this conditioning that has happened down through time immemorial. And because we have lived many generations, we have lived many lives with this preoccupation, it is not an easy thing to let go of. If it were just a matter of the conscious mind, we could at any moment make a decision of will and say, I now stop this preoccupation. But it's not that simple, because we also have an unconscious mind. And in the unconscious mind is all the reposited memories and thoughts and feelings and actions of everything that we have ever done. So this unconscious mind then goes to work. And even when the conscious mind tries to make an effort to say, stop this now, the unconscious mind continues to feed us these preoccupations, these thoughts, these fears, these desires, these longings, all the rest of it. And so it is not just a simple thing of changing the conscious mind by the use of the will, but rather it is a matter of refining and purifying both the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. Now, the greatest method we are told for doing this is keeping our mind constantly on God. You see, this mind is constantly creating. Every moment you are creating. In this moment you are creating, and this one, and this one. You are creating thoughts of restlessness, or of peace. You are keeping your mind focused on God or those things of the world. Your mind may be focused on my words in this moment, but in the next moment, you may be off on your own fanciful journey that has been triggered by something that was said, something about your past or your future or your hopes or your dreams or your desires. And so it's difficult to focus and concentrate the mind upon God. But to do this, we pick an object of God, or a syllable of God, a sound of God, or a word of God, something that for us represents the highest aspect of truth. Now, to one degree, it doesn't make any difference what we decide to focus on, as long as it represents that highest element for ourselves. So whether we focus on Allah or on God, or if we are Buddhist concentrating on Nirvana, or any of the other multitude of names for that infinite creative intelligence, it all comes down to the same thing. What inspires that faith and that focus of attention of letting go of everything from the outside? You see, distractions will come through the senses, different noises or sounds, different sights, different restlessness of the body, and all the rest of it will come and try to take our attention away. Or the conscious mind will be running from here to there, making plans for the future, or having regrets or thoughts about memories of the past. Or the unconscious mind will be letting up, Perhaps those long repressed thoughts, perhaps they come with fear, or they come with regret, or they come with some great desire nature behind it. And so this path requires that we let go of our attachment to all of these things. One way of thinking about this is like these thoughts are like tiny thought bubbles, and they are floating up through your mind, and like Velcro, they stick to you in some way or another. And lots of thoughts may come through, but only certain ones stick to you. And if you can let go of those and release them and remain free, because you see, those thoughts begin to encompass you. They begin to crowd you in. They begin to narrow your vision from a universal vision to a tiny myopic sphere. Have you ever had the experience of perhaps driving someplace or walking someplace? And here is a bright, beautiful day all about you, and nature singing its song and all the rest of it. But you are focused on a thought so completely that you are not aware of it. It is like you are indrawn to the point where you are not even aware, and you may be walking automatically or driving automatically. So really, this mind is a wonderful thing. It is that same ability to focus that you want to bring to bear on the spiritual problem. When you are able to bring your whole attention towards that one God thought, whatever form, whatever shape that takes, and you bring your whole self to it, then you begin the process of purifying the conscious mind and the unconscious mind, and you also open a channel to the superconscious mind. Now, the superconscious mind lies beyond both the conscious and the subconscious minds, and it represents your spiritual nature. It represents all the wisdom-guided thoughts. It encapsulates the joy and the bliss and the peace and all of experiences that we would consider spiritual. Now, this represents your God consciousness. It is the highest concept of which you are capable. And so when you open yourself to that experience, you're not only just purifying the conscious and the subconscious minds, but you're opening yourself to the grace that comes from the superconscious mind that only accelerates that purification process. Now, what are you being purified from? It is the attachment that you have grown to have towards the senses, towards your sense of yourself, your thoughts of yourself, how you identify yourself to be, and all the things that represent limitations for you. Your superconscious mind is unlimited in scope and in potential, but the conscious and the subconscious minds have not yet come to realize that. So it is by having actual experiences in the superconscious mind that you come to know who and what your true nature is. And in this way, the great consciousness of which you were born from for the very beginning, Jesus said, from identifying himself from this highest consciousness, or what is sometimes called Christ consciousness, he said, from the beginning, I am. And before Abraham, I am. You see, Jesus had two ways of speaking about himself. One is as the Son of Man, the human aspect. When he said, I of myself am nothing, it is my Father who doeth the works. He was identifying himself with the individualized aspect of himself that is called the Son of Man. But when he said, before Abraham was, I am, you see, the wording in that is strictly impersonal. And that is him identifying with that highest consciousness. And many times you will find that these great masters speak from that place. And it is unintelligible to us who view it from a human standpoint. Meher Baba, oftentimes, who is a great, great God-man, spoke from that highest consciousness. He said he spent 44 years in silence, but he communicated through an alphabet board that he used to point to different letters and spell out words. He would write out words, but he didn't speak anything during this time. But he oftentimes talked about the next time that he spoke. And he said, the first time that I spoke, all of creation came into being. You see, he wasn't identifying in that moment. He was in an uplifted state of consciousness. And he was speaking from that consciousness. And he was not speaking as the Son of Man, as a human individual. But he was speaking from the place of being the Son of God, or that perfection of consciousness that is inherent within all of us. He continued to say that when I speak the next time, all of this world will be transformed and changed into the pure aspect of God. And so people continued to wait for him to speak, and 1 year would pass, and then 2 years, and then 5 years, and then 10 years. And it was a great test for many people. They came, they wondered, they thought, well, he didn't speak the truth now, did he? He said he would shortly speak this, and all the world would be changed. Now, what he was speaking of was that he had come with this commission from God that Ramakrishna was speaking of. When you receive a commission, you receive this inward assurance and this green light, a go-ahead, that you may carry on a work in his name. Now, it is not you as an individual who does this, but rather you become an instrument for that highest consciousness. A true spiritual master can pass that on from themselves to the next generation of devotees of God. And in this way, there is this guru-disciple relationship that continues on from generation to generation. Now, this does not guarantee that that next generation will have their full God realization. They alone can make that happen. But they have been given this commission to teach. And if they are what they should be, and they live their life as they should, and they strive with everything in their being to attain their full realization, then they will not only take themselves, but they will take others along with them towards their own God realization. Jesus again said, if I be lifted up, shall lift up all mankind with me. Now, if he were truly lifted up, we don't see the evidence that all mankind has been lifted up also. It just doesn't exist. We look about in the world and we see that that's not the present day state of consciousness. So did he speak an untruth? No, he did not, but you need to understand how that truth was to be conveyed. There is an internal sense of it, in that when that purity of God within you is activated, and you are beginning those experiences, and you feel that upliftment of spirit within yourself, then all humankind, or all those human tendencies within you, also begin to get lifted up and transformed into higher consciousness. Also, in an outer sense, that a true spiritual master, when they are lifted up, will lift up those who are with them, in order that helps to purify their own consciousness. You see, and so in this way, if everybody lived up to who and what they should be, then the entirety of mankind will become uplifted. But what the master says has an internal and an external meaning and can also have a universal meaning. So you see, masters speak from many levels of truths. They come with this commission to teach. and it's not always at the convenience of the individual. It is not so much for the spiritual master to measure up to the devotees, but for devotees to measure up to that highest God consciousness. The proof is in the tasting of the pudding, so goes the saying. If you are tasting God, if you feel God within you, if you start to undergo those transformative experiences, then you may know that you are on the right path. But if you are lacking in those experiences, then you must double your determination. You must surrender yourself and all that you are at the feet of this highest consciousness. And in this way, you will come to know who and what you truly are. And you will begin to discover those gems that lie within you. Now, what are the nature of those gems? The gems that you have within you are joy, ever new joy. We look to the world to find happiness in so many ways. We think, well, if I just had enough money, or if I just had enough possessions, or if I just had enough friends, or if I just had the right spouse, and so on and so forth, then I would be truly happy. But really, we are like little children that beg and beg for a new toy. And then once we get that toy, it's played with for a while, but as often as not, that toy soon sits out in the yard, in the rain, in the mud, rusting away, and their attention is on to the newest, brightest, next thing. And we are like that with the world. We look for this thing and that thing in order to bring us happiness. But one of these gems that comes to us is this ever-present, ever-new joy that doesn't come because we've attained anything or because we've gained something in a worldly sense, but because we have put our mind on the true and spiritual focus within our own being. So this joy, this bliss, this upliftment of spirit comes and lets us know that we are on the right track. One of the next gems that comes to us is an intuitive, wisdom-guided thoughts. Now, when our thoughts are focused on this world, we have a desire nature, and we want this and we want that and the next thing. We have fears, we have shame, we have thoughts confined and contained all by worldly experience. But when these wisdom thoughts come to us, they don't come as a result of cognition or of the cognitive mind working and figuring it all out. Rather, it comes as intuitive apprehension. It comes complete and total. And it's not just a thing of the mind either. It comes and it shakes our entire being. It resonates with every cell of our entire being. And we know it as a truth through and through. Now, in the beginning, it may come just as an intuitive hunch or an intuitive knowing and apprehension in that way. But later on, it becomes a continuous stream of consciousness that is like a direct pipeline to the superconscious mind that we have. And so these wisdom thoughts come to us in the most wonderful way. And they teach us things that we have never known before. There are times when I have given talks in this state of mind, and during that talk I've said something that I had never known before in the past. And then later on I wonder, well, is that true? You know, I begin to question it myself. And so I begin to look for confirmation from that, either through the scriptures or through a saint or through a further expansion and knowing within my own self until I am convinced through and through of the validity of that truth. We must be like rigorous scientists when it comes to this, because the mind can be very deceptive. And at one point we can think that we're getting the truth, but really it's something that's been manufactured by our own minds, and it doesn't have that quality to it. It doesn't have that integrity to it. that we must demand when we want to know whether it is the truth that we are getting. We must be willing to go to the mat for it. We must be willing to go all the way until we get a confirmation that is so solid, that is so terrific, that is so powerful within our own beings that it leaves no question of a doubt. And in this way, our minds are constantly being focused on greater and greater attainment of spiritual truth within us. And so in that search for truth, we draw closer to that infinite consciousness that is our divine mind, that is part of our divine heritage, of which we have come to know and come to be. The third gem that we get in this diving deep within our own beings is an acknowledgement and a knowingness that we are an eternal self. That our self is not dependent on this body, nor on our feelings, nor on any particular thoughts, but resides complete and whole from the very beginning, has always been here, and will always be here. You see, so much of the dis-ease that we have about living in this world is that we live on shaky ground. This body will someday die. It has come from dust, and someday it will return to dust. And so as long as we identify with this body, we live in a state of anxiety, either on a conscious or an unconscious level. It is not until we are cured of that body identification by identifying with the real and the true, the eternal self, of which we are all part and parcel, that we can gain any true sense of a measure of peace. And this represents great freedom. When we know ourselves to be our true and eternal self, and when I say that, there's a self with a capital S and a self with a small s. The small s represents this ego self that we have come to identify with this body. But the capital S refers to the self of the spiritual self, the eternal self. When we come into knowledge of that through experience, then we come to know ourselves not identified with this body, not identified with this ego, but identified with our true and everlasting nature. You may reflect and think about all the times that you have thought about your life or some actions that you have done with some sense of shame, some sense of fear about losing something about your life or about your body or all the rest of it. Those lists can go on and on and on. The numbers of things that we feel afraid about, the number of things that we desire because of our identification with this little self, the number of things that we feel ashamed about, that we feel small about, that brings our focus of attention to a tiny, tiny dot because we feel that small. And then you think about, as in our exercise at the beginning of this evening, about your great and eternal self and identifying with that life body that exists beyond this body, beyond this universe, beyond the astral universes, beyond the causal universes. This is your true and eternal self. And when you know that for certain through your own experience, you will not have any need to fear. You will not have any need to feel shame. You will not have any need to have a rampant desire nature, because you will know yourself as that complete and whole self. And so this is the third gem that is found deep within you. And when you find these three gems of bliss, of wisdom, and your true and eternal self, then you will have really arrived, and you will have brought yourself into a fuller state of realization. And when you have transcended all sense of self and see it as but a puppet that is dangling by the strings of the true and eternal self, then you will have put into right relationship yourself in the small s with yourself, the capital S. In the meantime, what we've done is we've put the self with the small s up on the throne and given it the keys to the kingdom. And it has no great plan in mind. It doesn't know what to do, but it just wanders willy-nilly from here to there. And so it just gets us in trouble. It's like opening Pandora's box. And the resolution is to discover who and what you are in your own spiritual consciousness. And you can do that by putting your mind on God totally and completely, purifying the conscious mind, the subconscious mind, accessing the superconscious mind until you put on your throne of consciousness your real and true and everlasting self. Then everything else operates in perfect conjunction with that knowledge. So you see, this is our true nature. And for us to cling on to this little self as it is, as if it is everything, as if it represented our true self, we will never find it there. We will never find bliss. We will never find our real wisdom and our real self. So let us make a resolution today and every day that we see that new day as an open and new slate, and that we can create upon it as we will. Habits are those things that keep us confined. So let us be in the mode of breaking our habits and seeking that freedom right within us, searching out for that presence within us, knowing that presence so thoroughly that we become saturated with it, and we feel the peace and the bliss and the wisdom, the pure essential self, with such great knowledge, such great awareness, such great experience, that we know ourselves truly to be made up of that. And when we do that, then we enter into true freedom. I'm going to stop here and just see and open it up to questions. And you have all been practicing this path for a while now, and just see what comes up for you. Just encourage you that if there are questions or thoughts in your mind, they probably exist in somebody else's, and so not to be afraid to ask. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or is it?
Well, I think our experience of it is that it is difficult. But we ourselves are the ones who have set that up. If you think about somebody who has gone into setting up a habit pattern for themselves, and perhaps it's eating at a particular time, and they eat more than what they would like to be able to eat at that time. And so that becomes an ingrained habit in them. Perhaps they learned it in their family, and then they carried on that tradition along as they go. That habit pattern becomes difficult for them to break when it comes time for them to want to change that. And yet it is they themselves who have set that pattern up. Now, true enough, they may have absorbed it from those who are around them. There are people who have influenced them. along in their lives. They may be able to look at emotional related issues and say, well, I'm feeding my feelings for this and that and the other thing. However, the issue still remains, how do you change that habit? And it is by bringing yourself into a position where you can make a choice to do something differently, to come up with a strategy in order to develop a new habit, something that will work better for you. And there may be many false tries as you go along with it. You may try this thing and that thing. You may continue to try the same strategy over and over again and not get anywhere with it. You know, one of my favorite definitions for insanity is somebody who continues to try to do the same thing over and over again and expects different results. You know, and I think we all get caught up in that at different times, that we continue, we want happiness, we want freedom, we want joy, but we find that we continue to repeat those same patterns over and over again. But who are we facing when we want to change those habits other than ourselves? It has been manufactured by our own minds and programmed into our own subconscious minds. And then what we do is we set up a feedback loop where the subconscious feeds it right back into our minds again. Now, the only place where we can begin to break that pattern is right in the conscious mind, in the moment. What do we choose to give life to? What do we choose to focus our mind on? The life force comes in through the medulla, which is at the base of the skull here in the back of the head. Comes into the brain and is distributed from the brain and down out through all the nerves. This provides the life and the light by which this body exists. Now, if we could realize that fully, we would even remove the need for food. And there have been different saints that have proven that. However, most of us have not fully realized it, or it is not God's intention that we live that way, so we don't. But when we want to change something, we focus our mind on the something that we want to remove. But when we do that, we flood it with life energy. If I told you not to think of a pink elephant, you would, first thing you would think of is a pink elephant, because you would have to think of what not to think of before you could not think of it. So when you want to remove a bad habit, we think about how much we detest that habit, how much we don't want it, how much we don't like it. In reality, we're feeding life energy into it and we're making it stronger. So the trick is to stop that focus of our attention on that area and then divert our mind into some more positive avenue. Nature abhors a vacuum. So just to stop a particular thought won't work because something will rush in to fill up that vacuum. And that vacuum will be filled probably by those old unconscious thoughts again. So by putting our mind on God, we put our mind on the highest aspect within ourselves. And this begins to change the mind, but it doesn't happen in a moment. It is a thing of a process. It is a thing that we must continue with. And what are called temptations are actually impulses and thoughts and memories from the past, desires for the future, all the rest of it, that make us feel less than complete. That unless I have this object or a person or a situation out in the world, then I myself will be incomplete. And that desire nature can be very strong, but it's been fed by our own conscious mind down through millennia. And so it seems to oppose, we seem to oppose ourselves. One part of ourselves wants to be an uplifted, pure freedom of consciousness. Another part is pulling ourselves down to the way that we've always been. And so we find that we're in this mighty struggle. But we're not in a struggle with anything or anybody other than our own selves. And we ourselves have created. So if we don't like the quality of our life, if we don't like the quality of our consciousness, we have no further to look than our very selves as to why this has occurred and what we've gone into programming with ourselves. So we can cry in our beer if we want to and say, boy, I wish my life were different. But that's not going to make it happen. What we need to do is have a firm determination. Create in our minds a clear picture of who and what we want to be. That's on a human standpoint. And then create new habits for ourselves. From a spiritual standpoint, we put our mind on God. We make that the complete and total focus of our attention. And that starts the great purification process that lifts us up from the subconscious, the conscious minds, into the superconscious minds. And it's because of the length of time that we have gone into programming ourselves this way that it seems like it's a tremendously difficult journey. And there's no doubt about it. It is. And I think it would be hopeless if it were not for this grace that comes from the superconsciousness into our minds and helps us out. And this is the Savior within us. This is the redemptive consciousness within our own selves. And this is what makes it possible. It requires everything on our part to keep our minds pure, to keep them focused. But it also requires this grace from the superconsciousness that comes down and actively gets involved in the transformation. Otherwise, we could develop good habits and become a better person, but we could not transcend what it is to be human and move into the divine. So what's required there is divine consciousness. So when we invoke that, then that comes into our consciousness, into our beings. That's what makes it possible. And that's what the true Savior within us is all about. It's not about some individual who lived thousands of years ago. It's about that immanent aspect of purity that's already within us. Does that help to answer your question?
It does.
Mm-hmm. Well, that infinite consciousness of which we're part and parcel gave us free will as an individualized self. And through that, we have chosen to create exactly who and what we are. And even Yogananda asked Sri Yukteswar this when he resurrected himself. And Sri Yukteswar gave himself an out, and he says, let's leave a few questions for eternity, shall we?
Not fair.
I think if we want to know the answer to that, and we have a burning desire to know this answer to that, then take that question to God. Make that your rallying cry that takes you all the way. It must be a burning desire in us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not something that the human mind can just grasp. It must be a thing of revelation. Yeah. See, that desire to know the truth beyond anything else, beyond, you know, all confusion, beyond, well, is it a little bit of this or a little bit of that? That desire to know the truth is tremendously strong in us. And that desire to know the truth can take us all away. And that achieving that consciousness, whether it's done through love or desire to know the truth or discrimination of a powerful mind, whichever path we take takes us to the same goal, and then all those qualities are present. So it's said that all paths are equally good. It's which one does fits our nature. For myself, that desire to know the truth beyond all question has been a terrifically strong desire in me. I've wanted no sentimentality, no false sentimentality, no swallowing somebody else's words or concepts. I want to know it, and I want to know it for myself. So it's a very powerful way. Well, there's a saying that says that God is simple, all else is complex. And I think that the mind really adds complexity to everything. We can cut through a lot of the chaff by just going directly for the truth. But demand it. Demand it to the point where there's no question of a doubt. You're not just accepting my words or anybody else's words. You know it with the fullness of your being. It's a thing that attracted me to this path. It was a thing of experience. It wasn't accepting things by faith. There's a certain amount of that in the beginning. You feel intuitively that this is the right way for you. But I want to know that without qualification. And the mind does not have the capacity to do that in the human sense. That you must go beyond that into intuitive, wisdom-guided thoughts. Your mind and where you focus it is your ticket. And the price that you pay is when those worry thoughts storm at you, when those desire natures rail inside of you, that you cut through them and stay true. Because you see, as soon as your mind diverts towards them, you're giving them life again. So we become our own worst enemies. And we have a wish-fulfilling tree right inside of us. We have the power to fulfill our wishes. But what do we truly wish for? And it's not just a thing of the moment, but it's got to cut all the way through until we purify the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. And that total wish is to know the truth of who and what we are. It's lovely to meet like this, isn't it? Background, this wonderful altar of God behind us. Candle is lit in the background. Shining oranges and yellows, golds. And it's wonderful to meet in an intimate setting, talking about my favorite subject. You know, we have a wonderful group here. I'm just so thankful. When you come together, and all of us focused on that intention of knowing and realizing God, you know, it puts us in harmony with that highest truth. And I know that it's not always easy. But sometimes the body calls its attention for you. Sometimes the desire nature comes up. Sometimes the fears are there. It's true for everyone who's ever set their feet on this path. So don't think that you're alone. Don't think that you're the only one. This is true for everyone. But this is not a time to stay focused on that. Let those thoughts go. Let them pass on by. If the body becomes afraid, see it as the body experiencing fear. If the body experienced desire nature, just let it go. See it as the body desire nature there. Keep your mind focused on where it should be. And when you do that, you will find that there is such rich kingdoms inside of you, such rich experiences, and not just an experience here and there, but that you go to unqualified universal vision, that you see God within yourself and everywhere about you, that you feel the upliftment and bliss and consciousness as a continuous state of consciousness and that you can say to yourself, I have a body, but I am not my body. I have feelings, but I am not my feelings. I have thoughts, but I am not my thoughts. I am the eternal self. And when you realize this, then you have really arrived. You really have. So let us all go to God together. Let us all support each other, love each other, give to each other, in moving towards this highest consciousness. And when we do that, we not only uplift our own consciousness, but we help this world by visible and invisible means to help change this consciousness, the consciousness of the world. And when we look around and we see the violence, and we see the dishonesty, and we see the wars and the rumors of wars and all the rest of it, this world needs our healing help. And the best way to give it is to tune your mind in to your own highest consciousness. And in this way, you send out a vibration to this whole world. And that when enough of us do it, that light will go out like a wave, like a pebble thrown into a pond that creates a wake that goes out and spreads throughout the whole pond. That will go out like a wave around this whole earth. And that light will help to uplift and change the consciousness of every individual on this earth. So that's what we can do together, as well as to realize our own universal self. So it's wonderful to come together with this purpose in mind. And I just feel such great love in my heart for each and every one of you as we sit in the summer's evening talking about God and Spirit, things of truth and of beauty, and these eternal and lasting truths.
Some time tomorrow for individual interviews if anybody would like that. Also, the current plan is September 19th, 20th, and 21st. We plan on having a retreat up here at Phyllis's. We're inviting people from Seattle and Vancouver, and also I think from Los Angeles. We'll have somebody coming. And so it should be a wonderful time, and you're certainly all welcomed. On Saturday night, we plan on having a kirtan and meditation, and so it's a wonderful time to spend with other devotees of God, and to be able to take that opportunity to be with each other in that way. And it also happens to coincide with the autumnal equinox. So that's nice also, I think. Sri Yukteswar oftentimes said that those were special times of openness in consciousness. So that's a nice time for us to be able to gather and to be able to do it on your home planet here. Pray after me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every heart part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet. And surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Bliss.